Warning.
Hi, this is Jim from Safety Wars. Before we start the program, I want to make sure everyone understands that we often talk about OSHA and EPA citations, along with some other regulatory actions from other agencies, legal cases, and criminal activity. Everyone is innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Proposed fines are exactly that, and they are often litigated, reduced, or vacated. We use available public records, news accounts, and press releases. We cannot warranty or guarantee the details of any of the stories we share, since we are not directly involved with these stories, at least not most of the time. Enjoy the show.
This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
And from the border of liberty and prosperity and the highway to the north, this is Safety Wars for Tuesday, March 4th, 2025. We're headed right into season five. Second episode of season five. We had some stuff come up, so I am doing a pre-recorded program here. However, what is it going to be? It's going to be we are going to broadcast the entire hearing for Keith Sonderling from last week congressional hearing. So, I was at a Senate hearing. So, pardon me. Keith Sonderling was repeatedly questioned about the Department of Government Efficiency during his February 27th confirmation hearing before the Senate Health, Education, and Pensions. He is up for the Department of the Deputy Secretary of Labor, right? He's a nominee. And now we're just going to include his entire testimony here on the podcast, the first hour of it on the Safety FM network. And why am I doing this? Right? It's I'll have updated clips on my Rumble and YouTube and everything else. I'll have clips of this. Why are we doing this? Basic information. Right? We want to have basic information. We want all of our listeners and viewers and everyone to have a good handle on what's going on with the federal government and with all this stuff. This is the first time that we've been through this complete. Now, we went on the year of March 2001. This is like the first time we've gone through the complete thing here for everyone. So we're without, right? And I'm going to do a little... I won't even bother with the commercials. This is all brought to you by Safety Wars. And I will look forward to doing a program with you tomorrow. And like I said, we'll be uploading a lot of this stuff here. So, okay.
He will bring the sense of duty and commitment to the rule of law if confirmed as Deputy Secretary. While at the Wage and Hour Division, Mr. Sonderling was instrumental in developing President Trump's independent contractor policy, empowering millions of workers to earn a living in the manner in which they choose. He also clarified the joint employer standard, protecting the American franchise model employing over 9 million Americans. The Biden administration overturned these common sense policies, enacting a labor agenda hurting workers and the nation's economy. With President Trump back in office and new DOL leadership, I look forward to the return of pro-worker regulations at the department. Thank you for appearing before the committee. I look forward to hearing more about how you will implement President Trump's pro-American agenda to empower all workers and to create economic growth nationwide. I understand that, obviously, Senator Sanders is not here. So before we turn to the nominee for his opening statement, Mr. Sonderling will be introduced by Senator Rick Scott and former U.S. Senator George Lemieux. Of course, Senator, we would pronounce that differently in Louisiana, but I'll give you the Englishization. Senator Scott, you are recognized for introductory remarks.
Thank you, Chairman Cassidy, members of the committee. It's an honor to sit before you today to introduce a fellow Floridian, good friend Keith Sonderling, to this committee. I'd also like to recognize the many other Floridians here today, including Keith's parents, Barbara and Howard from Boca Raton, his wife, Farah from Aventura, also my good friend, George Lemieux. In nominating yet another Floridian to his administration, President Trump made an excellent choice in Keith to serve as Deputy Secretary of Labor. Throughout his career, Keith has proven time and again his deep respect for the rule of law and his abiding interest in the well-being of American workers and business owners. I know firsthand that Keith will succeed as the Deputy Secretary of Labor. While I was Governor of Florida, I had the pleasure of appointing him to serve on the Florida Judicial Nominating Commission for appellate courts in South Florida when he was just 29 years old. At the time, he was one of the youngest in the state's history to serve. He was tasked with recommending to me who should receive an appellate court judgeship. Historically, serving on this commission was reserved for the most senior attorneys in the state, but we saw this as an opportunity to give young leaders with great potential a chance to gain experience and prove themselves without waiting decades to serve. Keith has done just that, and I've been incredibly proud to see his success. His effectiveness and good judgment were shown throughout his term. He was quickly selected as chair and served with distinction, playing a significant role in reforming the nominating and selection process. At the same time, Keith excelled in the private sector by quickly becoming one of the youngest partners in one of Florida's oldest and most prestigious law firms. He's had a considerable impact throughout the state, serving in leadership positions in numerous nonprofit organizations. After serving the people of Florida, Keith left us to serve all Americans in the federal government. During President Trump's first term, Keith served in the U.S. Department of Labor, at the U.S. Department of Labor, overseeing a record number of enforcement recoveries and writing regulations that helped workers and assisted businesses in complying with the law. Just as I did, President Trump quickly realized Keith's potential and then nominated him as Commissioner of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Like many committee members here today, I proudly voted for his confirmation in 2020. Throughout his career, he has gone above and beyond to reach out to American workers and businesses to provide guidance and resources to help them comply with and navigate our country's labor laws. I can say with full confidence that Keith has served the people of Florida and the United States with distinction, and he is supremely qualified to serve as Deputy Secretary of Labor. On behalf of the 23 million residents of Florida, thanks for making us proud, and best of luck today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Senator Lemieux.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You've already heard a lot about Mr. Sonderling's impressive public service. Let me tell you a little bit about Mr. Sonderling from a perspective of a fellow Floridian and someone who worked shoulder to shoulder with him at the Gunster Law Firm. I've known Mr. Sonderling since he started his career in law. He is an expert in labor and employment issues. He not only counseled clients on those issues, but litigated them. He is hardworking. He is fair. He is honest. He is practical as to his integrity. And his ability to do a good job of public service, and I think that he will be unqualifiedly a great Deputy Secretary of Labor. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Sonderling, you have an opening statement. Introduce your family.
Thank you. First, Senator Scott and Senator Lemieux, thank you so much for that kind introduction. I'm so grateful for both of your mentorships. Chairman Cassidy, Ranking Member Sanders, and other members of the committee, first of all, it's really an honor to appear before all of you again, this time as President Trump's nominee to be the Deputy Secretary of Labor. I'm beyond grateful to the President for the opportunity to continue to serve our nation. In 2020, I had the honor of being unanimously approved by this committee as President Trump's nominee to be a commissioner on the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. I was subsequently confirmed by a bipartisan vote of the Senate. For the last 8 years, I have worked directly with members of this committee on both sides of the aisle on issues that impact hundreds of millions of American workers and employers. Over the past few weeks, it has been a pleasure to meet with many of you and learn more about your state's workforce challenges and opportunities. During our meetings, I promised that if confirmed, I will continue my longstanding commitment to work together to shape the future of the American workforce through President Trump's America First agenda. I want to take a brief moment to honor the people who have supported me throughout my life. My parents, who are here today, provided a firm foundation on which I am able to build a life of public service. My wife, Farah, my number one supporter, recognizes my deep commitment to serving our country, and of course, our two little boys, a three-year-old and a two-month-old, who are definitely not watching C-SPAN like everyone else right now. I also want to thank my colleagues at the Department of Labor and the EEOC for the chance to work with such dedicated professionals, and for everyone's encouragement for my next opportunity to serve. On a personal note, I think it is important to share what I consider to be a fundamental characteristic of who I am. I am the grandchild of Holocaust survivors. My interest in protecting all Americans' rights in the workplace is undoubtedly shaped by my grandparents, who, despite suffering unspeakable tragedies, were able to achieve the American dream. My grandmother, as a young girl, survived a concentration camp only by fleeing into the woods during Death March. My grandfather escaped the horrors of the Warsaw Ghetto and then joined the Allied forces. My grandparents lost generations of family members during the war. Fortunately, they were able to immigrate to the United States. However, once settled, they encountered more subtle forms of religious discrimination than those that they faced at the hands of the Nazis. Although more than willing to work, my grandparents lost employment opportunities based solely on their religious beliefs and life circumstances. It was only through their relentless hard work that they overcame the barriers put before them, ultimately paving the path for me to appear here before you today. Yet generations later, we are once again seeing a rise in religious discrimination. I am proud that President Trump issued executive orders tackling the generational resurgence of anti-Semitism and other forms of religious discrimination, including anti-Christian bias. My grandparents' bravery and dedication to hard work serves as my family's legacy. With this background, throughout my career in public service, my philosophy on the government's role in assisting workers and employers has been steadfast. Education and outreach to workers and employers go hand in hand with strong law enforcement. When I served at the Wage and Hour Division during President Trump's first term, we achieved back-to-back record-breaking enforcement recoveries for workers and more outreach than ever before, all with fewer resources. My record of balancing law enforcement, providing compliance assistance, modernizing outdated regulations, and proactively addressing workplace issues demonstrates my shared belief that under President Trump's leadership, we will be prepared for the opportunities and challenges facing the workforce over the next 4 years. As President Trump said throughout his campaign and when he nominated Secretary Chavez Dreamer and myself to lead the Department of Labor, we must put American workers first and give everyone a fair shot at the American dream. The president's vision embodies my grandparents' and countless other Americans' legacy. If I have the privilege of being confirmed as Deputy Secretary of Labor, I look forward to continuing to make this a reality for all Americans. Thank you for having me, and I look forward to our discussion.
Thank you. I'll begin the question. Mr. Sunderland, during the first Trump administration, DOL understood that more than 27 million gig workers rely on the flexibility of independent work to make a living while balancing personal responsibilities. The Biden administration sought to strip these workers of this flexibility by implementing what has failed in California, but a California-style legal framework. As Deputy Secretary, do you commit to re-implementing the independent contractor standard used in the first Trump administration so workers are free to earn a living in a way that works best for them?
Well, first of all, thank you, Chairman Cassidy, for not only having me today at this hearing, but the time we were able to spend together, not just for this nomination, but all of our working together the last 4 or 5 years. As far as referencing the independent contractor rule at the Department of Labor, that rule is currently under litigation. So if confirmed, I will certainly work with the solicitors and the department to ensure the best path forward with the current rule we have to deal with from the Biden administration that is in litigation. However, I do have a very strong record on this. And what we did in the first Trump administration, I, of course, stand by because it's based on longstanding legal principles. We did not make up a new standard. We used standards that the Supreme Court has blessed before and made it easier for workers to understand what the rules of the road were, determining, you know, for them if they are going to be an employee or independent contractor for the organization they work for, as well as employers. That everyone just wanted clarity. And you have my absolute commitment, not just with this rule, but every rule we do at the Department of Labor will be clear and understandable, and all comments from all sides will be reviewed.
The Biden-Harris administration made a number of attempts to benefit union constituencies, including by implementing rules that increase corporate control over small businesses. You signed the proposed joint employer rule during your time at Wage and Hour in the Trump administration, refocusing on who actually directs an employee's work day to day. If confirmed, do you intend to re-implement a joint employer rule focusing on direct control instead of the Biden administration's broad unworkable standard?
Well, again, if I'm lucky enough to be confirmed, I'm committed to looking at all the rules and regulations. The one you reference now is not under litigation, but obviously that is something we're going to take a look at very closely, and it's the same analysis that I just discussed with the independent contractor rule. It's how do we actually have factors that are easy to understand for both workers and employers? It's all about clarity, and it's also about not legislating from the executive branch and looking at standards that courts have approved that align with Congress's intent regarding the employment relationship. And you have my full commitment. That's exactly what I'll do as Deputy Secretary, working on any rules and regulations, including the joint employer rule. But to the joint employer rule specifically, and I know that was withdrawn by the Biden administration, it was based on existing case law. It was based on four factors that had been established and that were easy to understand to benefit both workers and employers.
To put a little flesh on that, I'm just going to ask you, I think you answered this, but let me just kind of drill down a little bit. Am I correct in assuming that you believe that a broad joint employer or standard hurts small businesses and employees as opposed to a more narrowly focused group?
That's correct, and that's what we documented during the first Trump administration. It wasn't ever about taking any rights away from workers. It was about what does the case law say and how do these businesses operate in the model that they intend as business owners and how their employees also want to be dealt with and treated. And that's always what we looked at, and that's what we'll continue to do again.
Sounds great. Next, the Biden-Harris administration routinely implemented a kind of one-size-fits-all policy. From its efforts to implement a California-style ABC test for independent contractors to a nationwide heat standard rule to efforts to punish rural communities by shutting down volunteer fire departments with top-down emergency response regulations. Just as a philosophical thing, how valuable do you think it is for DOL to consider the effects on different communities before implementing a one-size-fits-all new policy for the entire country?
It's not only what we should be doing, it's what the law requires us to do under the administrative. Any rulemaking we do, we need to hear from all constituents and review them and to make the best possible determination. But for your specific question, it's very important, of course, that we balance health and safety measures for workers ultimately, but also that, you know, in the case you're referencing, that fire departments are able to comply with these rules and not have to shut down and then not provide emergency services predominantly in rural areas.
Senator Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good to see you again.
Thank you for meeting me.
In 2024, following an OFCCP evaluation, one of the largest global financial service companies agreed to allocate $4.2 million in payments to resolve alleged sex discrimination and undergo an outside pay equity analysis. In his first week in office, President Trump rescinded the executive order from 1965 that authorized OFCCP to conduct that investigation. Commissioner Sonderling, do you believe that taxpayer dollars should go to companies that discriminate?
Senator, first of all, thank you for the question and for meeting with me. You have been, throughout my time in government, I've enjoyed working with you, both in my prior nomination and this nomination. Regarding the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Procedures at the Department of Labor, President Trump did rescind Executive Order 11246, which was the jurisdictional basis for that. However, not a single U.S. worker has lost any civil protection rights because of that rescission.
Well, my question wasn't that.
Title 7.
I wanted to ask you, do you think that taxpayer dollars should go to companies that discriminate?
Senator, that is not a determination that the Deputy Secretary of Labor or the Department of Labor deals with. There's a jurisdictional issue at the Department of Labor where that executive order is no longer there. But as I committed to you before, the Department of Labor will still completely and fully enforce the laws.
I don't think the taxpayer dollars should go to companies that discriminate. I can easily say that. Let me go on. In our meeting, you suggested that Department of Labor is looking at eliminating OFCCP entirely, even though it has recovered now more than $260 million for more than 250,000 employees and job applicants who were discriminated against by federal contractors over the last decade. And OFCCP just today announced plans to cut 90% of its staff and dozens of local offices. So let me ask you this. Do you think DOL has any role to play in addressing illegal discrimination?
First of all, Senator, I'm not aware of that report. And we did discuss about how we can move forward with the rescission of the executive order and still enforce the Veterans, the Vietnam-era Readjustment Assistance Act, and also 503 of the Rehabilitation Act, which are still laws that the Department of Labor, civil rights laws, that the Department of Labor
have to enforce. I'm just asking you from your own philosophical, personal position, do you think that DOL, which you are going want to go to work for, has any role in playing to play in addressing discrimination in this country?
Well,
or not? Do you think DOL? Should
of course, DOL is the most important agency, in my humble opinion, related to all workplace rights. However, the specific question is related to discrimination, which now is the full jurisdiction of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission under Title VII.
And well, it's interesting that you say that because Trump fired two of the EEOC commissioners in an unprecedented move, I would add. So it really has undermined our government's ability to go after anti-discrimination. So I am, and everyone should be deeply concerned about that. Let me go on, because I just have a minute left, and this is important. We're hearing a lot about DEI. It's thrown out there everywhere. So I'm going to ask about some bipartisan laws passed by Congress that were passed to make sure that underserved Americans can receive workforce training and find good employment opportunities. And I want to know if the policies in these laws that I'm going to present to you amount to DEI. The Office of Disability Employment Policy has been statutorily authorized with, I'm going to quote, eliminating barriers to the training and employment of people with disabilities. Is that DEI? Yes or no?
It is important to protect all rights of disabled workers. And, under my leadership, the Office of Disability Employment will continue to do that.
So that is not DEI?
That is a civil rights statute that the department enforces to make sure disabled people can
I know you know what it is, but I'm asking if it's DEI because, you know, it's very confusing. How about the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, WIOA? It specifically, quote, says individuals with a barrier to employment and requires grantees to expand training to those individuals. Is that DEI?
WIOA is a very important law, as everyone in this room
consider that to be DEI?
I consider that to be a very important part of the department's mission to make sure that American workers can get the training they need.
Is the Vietnam-era Veterans Readjustment Assistance Act of 1974 requires federal contractors to take affirmative action to hire, retain, and promote veterans? Is that DEI?
It is important to protect all of our veterans. It's important to protect everybody in the workplace.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I know you're pounding your gavel, but I just think it's pretty clear that there is no standard definition of DEI across our federal government. We should be very careful what we are saying and putting out there in the public.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Marshall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sonderling, welcome. It's good to see you again. We've had some great discussions about workforce development. Look, we want everyone to have a job. In Kansas, the biggest challenge we have is water. We're not going to fix that today. And a lack of people for the jobs that we have. That there are lots of jobs that are going unfulfilled. Jobs that would pay a great salary, a starting salary, $80,000 a year, but they're not inside of an office. It's using your hands. And it's working outside in the Kansas weather as well. But what can you do? What could you do at the department later to help empower the workforce to have the skill set for the jobs that we have available in the state of Kansas?
Well, I really enjoyed our meeting very much, Senator, and to talk about the issues within Kansas, not just on the workforce development side, but the various issues related to your workforce. And I really look forward to continuing moving on that. As far as our discussion about workforce, I really enjoyed how we talked about, you know, there's always going to be those vocational traits, whether it's through apprentices or otherwise. And we need to keep encouraging individuals to go in that, who may not want that traditional four-year degree. And that is exciting for those programs to be expanded and continue. But as we talked about, how do we now make other types of apprenticeships cool? You know, and there's a lot of people who don't want to go to traditional four-year degrees. You think about everything related to technology. You have 12, 13, 14-year-olds who can code and do AI better than some of the top scientists at Google. And they may not want to go to a four-year program because they are able to enter into the tech workforce right now. So how do we expand apprenticeships or other opportunities?
How do we do that? How do we do it?
Through the Department of Labor.
Tell me how.
We're going to promote that and try to, in addition to the traditional vocational side, we're going to try to get other companies to get involved, in more tech-type companies to get involved in this equation, and also work on the
individual. So often in D.C. we work in these silos, and I think there's this opportunity that we need to work with the Department of Education. Right now our Pell Grants are really geared up for the four-year university, graduate with a high volume of a debt load and a job that's a fraction of what you could if you were willing to go work with your hands as well. So what would you be advising, or how could you work with the Department of Education?
Well, we will work closely with our colleagues at the Department of Education to ensure that all this, you know, the federal money, whether it's on the Pell Grants, on the WIOA, are actually going to those students who want to engage and learn different traits, learn different areas.
Come on, Max, one of the funniest interviews I've ever been involved
in. Funds or that type of workforce training. And I think that's a messaging, and I think that's something we can all work on together on how we do that.
I think it's prioritizing the dollars. We have a finite amount of dollars. We have to prioritize those as well. You know, the unions do just a great job with their apprenticeships, with their, shorter, 8-12-week courses as well. Is there, what can we do to amplify those? I understand there's an education part of it, but how do we, what can we do in the federal government level to make sure that any monies we are giving out are being able to be used for those?
Well, this is an important part of the Department of Labor's Employee and Training Administration to make sure all those federal dollars are actually going into workforce training developments that's going to achieve results. And I think, if confirmed as Deputy Secretary of Labor, I will work with that division and work with all the senators in this room to make sure that those dollars going to your states are actually producing those results, both in what you think traditionally of the apprenticeship programs and also reimagining different paths.
Yeah, to me, again, I'm going back to this prioritize. We're spending plenty of money. I just don't know if it's going in the right places as well. What my last question looks like. How could you at the Department of Labor use resources more efficiently and ensure that these funds will be properly spent and accounted for?
Well, you have my commitment. Our team will look at all federal dollars being spent from the workforce and make sure that they're getting results. These are still taxpayer funds, and we need to not only make sure that they're being used properly, but the education these students who are receiving these federal funds are actually leading to very good jobs. And I think that's going to be the first indication of that. And that's what President Trump's agenda is.
My last piece of advice is that we need to measure that success. And I hope when we get to visit here in 3 months, hopefully you're confirmed, is how do we measure success? And to me, it's some type of a very simple formula. We spent this much money on these different programs. And then did this person get a job when they finished? What was their debt when they started a job? What was their starting salary? And maybe a point towards the future, what's a 10-year salary? But we have to start measuring success. And then we see if we're spending dollars on a certain program and there's no return on that investment, then we need to eliminate those.
I look forward to working with your office on that, if confirmed.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
Senator Murphy. Senator Kane.
Mr. Sonderling, congratulations on this nomination and welcome to your family. You are a senior advisor to the acting secretary. How many Department of Labor employees have lost their jobs since the beginning of the Trump administration?
I am a senior advisor right now at the U.S. Department of Labor. I don't have the authority over hiring and firing decisions.
Do you not know the answer?
I do not know the answer.
Who would know the answer to the question?
The acting secretary works with the career staff, both in the solicitor's office.
Do you think the acting secretary would know?
And the assistant secretary of management, the professionals in the HR team at the U.S. Department of Labor.
Is the answer to my question one that you're interested in or disinterested in?
If confirmed as Deputy Secretary of Labor, Senator, that is going to be...
You work there now. You're there right now.
I am a senior advisor. I don't have the authority over HR, but I will eventually.
And in your testimony, you say, my interest in protecting all Americans' rights in the workplace. You're including federal employees, including the employees of your own agency. Is that correct?
I'm including every worker in the United States.
Good. I guess I know the answer to this next question, which is, do you know how many veterans have been fired at the Department of Labor since you began working there on Inauguration Day?
I do not.
Are you interested in that question or disinterested in that question?
Of course I'm interested in all the employees.
And you're aware, because you've worked with the federal government before, that pretty high percentage of the federal workforce is veterans. About 30% of the civilian workforce is veterans.
And it's a tremendous honor for the federal government.
Yep. Highly disproportionate number of disabled veterans. Probationary employees have been laid off in the Department of Labor as well as other agencies, correct?
Pursuant to OPM guidance and executive orders.
Just correct or incorrect?
I read that as well.
Yeah. Probationary employees, just so folks know, they're not on probation because they did something wrong. What that means is they're new employees. And they tend to either be young employees or career switchers, like veterans. Veterans serve in the military. I have a veteran who served for 25 years in the Marine Corps, lives in Dumfries, Virginia. Mr. Musial is his name. Service-disabled vet, 5 years deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan multiple times. He left the military as a colonel in 2019 and got a job with a federal agency for 4 years. And then he got recruited to join another federal agency in March of last year. And he served, and now he's 30 years of service to the country, but he's a probationary employee, and he just got fired. The numbers are coming in. People like you generally can't answer questions like this in hearings, but the numbers are coming in, suggest that Donald Trump has fired more veterans than any president in the history of the United States. In 6 weeks! Is that a good thing or a bad thing, or are you indifferent to it?
If confirmed, I can promise you that I will follow all applicable law. I will make sure the HR department follows all applicable laws.
The if confirmed line works for somebody who isn't in the building. People have been using that line. If they're not in the building, I can't expect them to have answers to questions. You are a special advisor to the acting Secretary of Labor, and I've asked you a question. Is mass firing of veterans who are federal employees a good thing, a bad thing, or are you indifferent to it?
First of all, I truly respect all veterans in the service of their country. I've hired veterans have worked for me. I understand the sacrifice they've made personally.
Do you dispute what I am saying, that veterans are disproportionately suffering by the Trump layoff policies?
Senator, I haven't done the workforce analysis.
So you can't dispute it, but you recognize what I've said, that 30% of the workforce is veterans, and veterans are disproportionately in probationary status because they've come from one federal agency to become a civilian with the federal government.
I can assure you that the professional career staff at HR, the Department of Labor, and the Solicitor's Office, who are complying with all executive orders and OPM directives, are absolute professionals and will follow the law and have a duty to make sure that nobody is discriminated against them, protected characteristics.
When you are aware that the workplace is disproportionately veteran and you engage in mass layoffs, you're disproportionately affecting veterans. The civilian workforce is less than 5% veteran. The federal workforce is 30% veteran. You have said that you have an interest in protecting all Americans' rights in the workplace, but you can't even answer a question that I'm asking you about your own workforce. Now, I know you've only been there for 6 weeks, but you are in a highly elevated position. You can't tell me how many folks have been fired. You can't tell me how many are veterans. You're not exactly sure who could give you the answer. You haven't apparently been interested enough to get the information to be able to answer my questions. I just want to hold you to your standard. If you want to protect all Americans' rights in the workplace, that better include veterans. I yield back.
Senator Husted.
Thank you, Chairman Cassidy, Mr. Sonnerling. Welcome, and congratulations on your nomination. On the first Friday of each month at 8:30 in the morning, the Bureau of Labor Statistics announces a jobs report. In my previous work as Lieutenant Governor of Ohio, I was in charge of economic development and workforce development. We used to watch that report very closely in instructing our work. And we would certainly, though, not watch it as closely as the Federal Reserve, who makes interest rate decisions based on that, and certainly not as closely as the stock market and the people who invest in this nation, because those statistics are really important for a lot of people in making decisions about where the direction of the economy is going. And so on that basis of how important that is, I was shocked in August of 2024 to find out that the BLS overreported the number of jobs between March of 2023 and March of 2024 during the Biden administration by 818,000 jobs, 30% overestimate about the number of jobs that were created during that time period. That's stunning to think that that could have happened by that large of a margin. And so I'm interested in knowing, because this is a time when we have access to all kinds of data. We have more data and more ways to collect information than ever. I'm interested in clearly this is a flawed system. Is it subjected to manipulation? Is it incompetence? Or is it just an outdated way of trying to measure, make these measurements? And so my question is, what can we do to improve that? Do you have thoughts?
Thank you, Senator, and for raising that issue. You and I have discussed this at length, and I think, you know, the first and foremost related to public trust and transparency in any of these positions is paramount to anything. And if the public cannot trust the federal agencies to be doing the jobs they're supposed to be doing, it's going to be very difficult for these agencies to continue their mission. So that's what I'm very excited about President Trump's leadership and this administration. That's why he was voted into office, to be able to bring back that public trust and transparency in these organizations. To your specific question, the Bureau of Labor Statistics that does the jobs reports that where you reference on the job correction, which obviously made national news, is an agency that's independent of the Department of Labor. So what I can promise you is that, you know, if confirmed, we will work with our partners at the Bureau of Labor Statistics to ensure that they have all the resources they need to be able to accurately and timely put out the job numbers without questions.
That's great, because I think this is an incredibly important issue in terms of how decisions get made in this country. It is a matter of public trust. And I would ask you to report back to us on what you learn as you take a look at this and how we can get better. Senator Marshall talked to you a little bit about apprentices and how we can get better. Have you given any thought to the idea that a lot of jobs today we are saying you need a college degree for, but really you could just apprentice that job and credential that job, and it might not need a college degree to be able to, say, go to teach in high school for auto body repair or some of these many career tech kind of jobs that the workplace experience that you had out in the marketplace may be a better way for you to do this? And is there any way that we could improve upon that, do you believe?
Absolutely. And this was, you know, part of President Trump's campaign to improve the life of American worker, for them to have choices. And it shouldn't be, you know, workers, students should have options. If they want to go to a four-year college and pursue that, they should be able to. If they want to go into trades or vocational or any of these different apprenticeship programs, we should encourage and do both. And I think that the Department of Labor plays the strongest role in ensuring for those who do not want to go to the traditional four-year colleges to get into the many options we have on various workforce development training programs, whether it's apprenticeships or other kinds of participating bodies we have at the department in ETA related to ways to develop the workforce.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and good morning, Mr. Sunderland. Congratulations.
Thank you, Senator.
To you and your family on your nomination. Just a couple of things. First of all, as I understand it, last week at your staff interview, you were asked some of the very questions about numbers of layoffs at the Department of Labor that Senator Kane just asked you. And so if you were, in fact, interested, given that you are, in fact, a senior advisor at the department, we would have expected you to have gone back and been prepared for those questions and had answers. So it is concerning, and it raises a little bit of skepticism on my mind about how interested you are really about who's being laid off at the Department of Labor and what kind of process, a term I'm using loosely because it doesn't seem there is any process with this administration about how they're going about these layoffs, was used. But let me start with a question I've been asking all nominees. And it's a really simple question, and it is related to recent events. If directed by the President of the United States to take an action that would break the law, would you follow the law or follow the President's directive?
President Trump would never ask me to do that.
President Trump, let's just be really clear, is a convicted felon. He has violated the Impoundment Control Act that has been ruled constitutional by the United States Supreme Court. He has pardoned violent offenders, some of whom have now been rearrested for new acts of violence, including rape. And he has just aligned the United States of America in a vote at the United Nations with two of the most brutal dictators in the history of modern, in modern history, Russia and North Korea. So the notion that he wouldn't direct you to do something that breaks the law stretches credulity. Now, second question. I am really concerned about attempts by members of Elon Musk's DOGE effort to access sensitive data in DOL systems without proper oversight. And I have a series of questions to ask you on this topic. First, the Department of Labor systems include the medical information of people who file workers' compensation claims, as well as the identities and personal information of people who file other employment and whistleblower complaints against corporations. If confirmed, how will you protect sensitive personal information at DOL?
Well, first of all, Senator, the U.S. Department of Labor is subject to a lawsuit by multiple unions regarding DOGE's access to the department.
And how are you going to go ahead, independent of that, what steps will you take to protect sensitive personal information at DOL?
I just have to let you know that the Department of Justice is representing a DOL in all DOGE matters, and all questions related to DOGE are being dealt with in the court.
It is really disappointing to me how eager you are to evade giving direct answers here. I'm also concerned that Elon Musk and any other member of DOGE could advance their own private business interests by exploiting sensitive information or undermining investigations at DOL. These conflicts of interest are real. So if confirmed, how would you address these significant conflicts of interest, conflicts that exist because DOGE has members who have had unfettered access to data that they can use for their personal and financial benefit?
Broadly, in this administration, the President has committed that there are no conflicts of interest. And relating to the Department of Labor, I'm very confident in the career solicitors and the career ethics officers who will ensure that there are no conflicts within the department.
Mr. Musk has extraordinary conflicts of interest. This is a guy who's gotten $38 billion in subsidies from the federal government. This is a guy who has ongoing investigations by the Department of Labor because of complaints from his employees. This is a guy who we don't know how he plans to use the data and whether he's planning to export it off to his own platforms to build his financial business. So, you know, you are a skilled lawyer. You know the answers to these questions. And your unwillingness to either stand up to the president, acknowledge that this is a president who isn't interested in following the law, and refusal to tell me that you will stand up for the people who work for the Department of Labor, whose data is kept by the Department of Labor, for the workers who are supposed to count on the Department of Labor to have their back, is really, really disappointing. My last question for you is about child labor violations and what you will do to protect child labor. But seeing that I'm out of time, I'm going to yield back and we'll submit that question for the record.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Banks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sonderling, I want to ask you the same question I asked Ms. Chavez de Remer. What does it mean to put American workers first in the 21st century economy?
Well, thank you, Senator Banks. I really enjoyed our conversation and working with your team. And this is what President Trump was elected for. And this is why I'm excited to join this administration. It's about putting the American worker first, period. And the duty of all his entire administration and also the Department of Labor, is to make sure that the American worker is protected in all the various areas. Now, why I'm personally biased and excited about the Department of Labor is because it meets all the different areas that President Trump campaigned on for the workforce, whether it's protecting worker salaries, whether it's protecting retirees' benefits and pension plans, whether it's helping America be healthy again through ensuring transparency in healthcare plans. It's just the entire scope of the Department of Labor from A to Z will really help move forward the president's agenda, what he wants with the workforce, which I know I'm sounding repetitive, because that's about putting the American worker first and nobody else.
Very good. Artificial intelligence holds a lot of promise, increased productivity, innovation in the economy, but it also threatens to wipe out a lot of jobs. How do we balance those two concerns that we have, one with growing our economy and the other with the jobs that could be lost through AI and other innovation?
And we have to look at this in various ways. The first and foremost position is that any use of artificial intelligence in the workforce, something obviously I'm very passionate about, complies with longstanding laws, whether it's civil rights laws, whether it's health and safety laws, to ensure that it's being used properly on the American workforce to actually help make them more productive, help make their jobs better, safer, more secure. And there's a lot of promise with AI on that. But on the flip side, if we don't have those American values built into it, if we don't have those civil rights protections built into artificial intelligence, not only are people potentially going to be discriminated, but the products are not going to be able to do what they are intended to do. So that's always been a passion of mine. But now in this role of the Department of Labor, it's much broader than that. Now, how do we make sure, number one, that the American workforce, that the American worker, are actually the ones being able to be trained on this, to be able to use it? How do we develop those programs in place, the Department of Labor, to train the next generation of workers to be confident about using AI, to not feel like it's going to make them lose their jobs, but it's going to make their jobs better? And I think that's a very important part of this administration. And then, of course, you know, we have to make sure that the products continue to be developed here and not overseas. And how do we do that? Again, through that proper workforce training that we've been discussing.
So it's illegal to hire illegal immigrants, but companies that hire illegal immigrants often commit other crimes, wage theft or breaking child labor laws, for example. I assume you agree that putting American workers first means that we hold companies accountable that break the law and hire illegal immigrants. My first question on that note is, why did the Biden administration refuse to allow ICE to go into businesses to crack down on big businesses who hired illegals?
I don't know what was going on during the Biden administration at ICE or the Department of Labor. What I can assure you in the Trump administration that you can enforce all laws, and you don't have to not enforce certain laws at the detriment to other laws. Whether it's immigration laws, whether it's employment laws, they can all be enforced together. And, you know, if confirmed as Deputy Secretary of Labor, you will have my full commitment that all of the laws that the Department of Labor enforces will be enforced, and all other agencies will also be able to enforce their laws equally as well.
I understand that the Department of Labor shares some of these responsibilities with ICE, who is the enforcement arm. But is it, correct me if I'm wrong, but is it true that the Biden Department of Labor blocked ICE from entering workplaces to enforce labor laws?
If confirmed, I can certainly work with you on those issues to see what was
going
on.
But you committed to us today that, along with Secretary to be Chavez de Remer, that you will not block federal law enforcement agencies from going into the workplace to enforce those laws to put American workers first.
We will work with all of our federal partners to make sure that all laws of the United States, and there's 180 of them at the Department of Labor, are fully enforced.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's crazy to me that the last administration would block law enforcement from going into workplaces to enforce these important laws. So that's the most important commitment that I've heard today. I appreciate you being here. You have my full support. I yield back.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Blunt Rochester.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Sonderling, for the meeting that we had. I will tell you, I started my work here today with a list of questions, but as I've heard other senators ask questions, I've gotten more and more concerned. I'm concerned when Senator Murray asked you if companies that discriminate should receive taxpayer dollars, you did not give a clear answer. I'm concerned that when the question of supporting people with disabilities and protecting them with their rights came up, and the question of, well, how does that relate to DEIA, and how does that relate to civil rights protections, you were not clear. I'm concerned that when we met, I asked you specifically about the employees at the department and how many of them were let go, or what should be the responsibility of this department for those workers. And numerous senators asked the same question, and it still wasn't clear. I literally, while I was sitting here, did a Google search and found on Bloomberg Law information about how many employees from the Department of Labor were let go. And so I understand the saying that we, or you, and this administration support American workers, but to the people who are dealing with avian flu, to the veterans who make up almost a third of the workforce, and half of those are disabled veterans, to the individuals who were nuclear scientists that protected our safety, to all of these workers, I don't think they feel very much seen or protected. And that has impact on all of us, all of our safety, all of our health. And so I only really have one question. My question is, are these employees also the American workforce that you would put first?
Of course.
I don't feel it, they don't feel it, we're not seeing it, and we're all starting to feel the impacts of this arbitrary, in some ways, using a chainsaw to get rid of employees that really do make a difference in our lives. I shared with you, I'm the former Secretary of Labor from the state of Delaware. What we are seeing is not workforce planning. What we are seeing is not smart when we have a national workforce shortage and we are just, you know, firing people that we need. So that was my only question. Again, very disappointed. And again, I would love to see not this same pattern of nominees coming in and saying, I'm sorry, I'm not in there yet. I can't answer that question, especially when you actually are in the department. I yield back.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, I was not here when we took the vote before the committee to confirm or to advance Lori Chavez Dreamer to be the Secretary of Labor. I intended to support her nomination moving out of committee. If it's appropriate, I would ask unanimous consent to be recorded as yes by proxy.
Without objection.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sonderling, thank you for the opportunity for discussion. Last week, as I shared with you probably at greater length than you wanted.
I enjoyed it very much.
Well, you learned a lot about fish.
Yes.
And that's okay.
Slime. We're going to do it together.
Slime. Yeah, we're going to take you up there. You're going to see for yourself. But I shared with you the disappointment that I've had over the years that the department can be an obstacle to us in obtaining H-2B workers by not processing timely these labor certifications. I shared that I think that the system is broken. We need these workers. We would love nothing more than to have 100% American workers, but our reality is despite every effort that we have made, we have been not successful with that. And if we don't have the workers, the fish can't be processed, and we have an industry that falls to its knees. So I really appreciate your commitment to working with me to help meet Alaska's seafood workforce needs. So I look forward to
it. You have my full commitment. We had a long, very technical discussion about the H-2B program, but you know, I really think that's a very good example of why there's a need for that program. And you know, as you know, the Department of Labor's jurisdiction related to this, it's not only to test the labor market, whether it be salaries or actually workforce, but this is an example where there is no local workforce, and we need this program to be able to succeed in both in Alaska Maryland, Virginia, more closer by with the seasons and the technicalities of this. I am fully committed to working on that with you together to make sure that the seafood seasons, which don't align necessarily with other temporary working seasons, that we're able to process those too. You have my full commitment on that.
Good. I look forward to working on that. Let me shift to our veterans. The Veterans Employment and Training Services Overseas Program, designed to help our vets transition service members and our military spouses. This is important as they're seeking to gain meaningful employment. An assistant secretary for this program for vets hasn't been nominated yet. Can you commit to prioritizing appointing a veteran who has firsthand experience with the challenges of transitioning to civilian development? Can you give me that kind of an assurance? I think it's important.
Absolutely. Let me say a few things on this. It is very important, in my opinion, that a veteran lead that department and one that understands the complexities of leaving service and coming into the private sector workforce. Somebody could actually help them with the military codes, change it to their resume, and see the types of jobs that are best to their skills. And that's a huge part of the vets permit to ensure that not only there's funding and training for that, but you actually can do that. I think you have my full commitment, and I'm going to speak on behalf of the hopefully soon-to-be Labor Secretary, that we will ensure that that role gets filled.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that. It is key. It's significant. And that kind of experience, you just can't replicate without having had that veteran background. I was here when Senator Hassan was talking about the sensitivity of information at Department of Labor, and know that this senator shares the concern about the confidentiality of that. We can talk pros and cons about how DOGE is moving through, but as I'm talking to Alaskans, one of the concerns that I'm hearing is we don't know why there are those who are gaining access. It may be fine, it may be not, but I'm nervous about it. I think that we can alleviate anxiety and nervousness by just saying your sensitive data is going to remain confidential. So I just wanted to put that out there on the record for that. I want to talk to you about apprenticeships, and we've shared the concerns that we have in rural areas. It's just hard. You've got folks who want to be part of the skilled workforce, but I think we need to find some more creative ways to support workforce development in rural areas, not just Alaska, other parts of the country, where communities are in a kind of disconnected from the traditional workforce. And I don't know if you have any specifics that you can give me in 20 seconds or just a commitment, but we need to focus on this rural workforce.
You have my full commitment, as we discussed in my last time at Wage and Hour. I studied the Alaska workforce both from a DOL perspective and the needs that the Department of Labor needs to give there. And you have my full commitment that we will work together again in this administration to make sure that all aspects of the Department of Labor programs are available in Alaska.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator also Brooks.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and good morning to you, Mr. Sonderling, and thank you for being here. Now, you've talked a lot in various points, today included, about your deep respect for civil servants and for those who are career servants at the Department of Labor and the important work that they do there every single day. Yet, unfortunately, this administration continues to attack these workers. The Department of Labor civil servants received the same email as others across government over the weekend, telling them to submit 5 bullet points describing the work that they had done over the last week, with Elon Musk saying to them that a failure to respond would be considered a resignation. Now, this directive, and I believe this was the point of it, caused chaos, confusion, and fear for department employees. And the Department of Labor staff apparently received, because of the sheer incompetence of this administration, mixed messages from their supervisors on how to respond. Now, some managers told staff that the choice to respond was at their discretion. And so I would like to know who was involved in making decisions at the department regarding the guidance that was given to department employees.
Well, thank you, Senator, for that question. The that the directives that come from OPM, whether it's the guidance related to responding to emails or not, goes to the Office of Assistant Secretary for Management at Department of Labor, which is the HR department at DOL. So any kind of response or not response, how to deal with it, I would have to defer to the professional staff at the HR department.
Were you involved in that decision making?
I was not, and I did receive that email myself.
Well, you are a senior leader in the administration on the landing team. Is that correct?
I've been in the administration since the first day as an advisor, correct?
Okay, and so how is it possible that you weren't involved in such a high-level decision as a person who's a senior part of the transition team? You've been there in the building, you have been a part of the landing team. How is it possible that you weren't involved?
It is a large agency, and there's professional career staff that handle various aspects of the department. The specific questions you're asking about go to the professional staff in the human resources divisions, which I don't manage and I don't have authority over, and I trust them fully.
But you were aware of these discussions.
I was not involved in the discussions.
But you were aware of the discussions and aware of the decision that was made to send this out.
No, I'm from OPM.
From Elon Musk.
I was not involved in any of that. I received the email the same time everyone did on Saturday after I read about it on Twitter.
Which I think again points to the sheer incompetence. To even send the email to you says something horrible about the people in the building. But given the issues with conflicting guidance, which we now acknowledge, you acknowledge, that there were issues with this conflicting guidance since you yourself received one of the ridiculous emails. I'd like to know, can you commit that no one will lose their job due to perceived non-compliance with Elon Musk's order?
If confirmed, and I have oversight of the HR department, I will commit to you that our HR professional career staff will follow all directives and all laws.
Okay, that doesn't necessarily answer the question because there are people who are on maternity leave who receive these messages and others. Will you commit to protect those individuals who had no opportunity to apply to respond?
I will make sure that the professional career staff in the HR department follows all regulations and all laws, and I trust them to do that.
Well, do those laws include collective bargaining agreements?
The department obviously has collective bargaining agreements with various federal government unions. There are divisions within the Department of Labor in that same HR group that handles all of those. They are the professionals in managing collective bargaining agreements and the unions, and I trust them fully to do their jobs.
Well, the reason I ask is because Ms. Chavez de Remer, who's here I know today, was unable to affirmatively commit to abiding to all terms and conditions of collecting bargaining agreements between the department and agency staff, saying, instead, I will work with the experts to understand the collective bargaining process at the department. So can you commit to abide by all terms and conditions of the department's collective bargaining agreement? And do you understand the collective bargaining process?
I am not a traditional labor lawyer. But I know we have a lot of experts at the Department of Labor career staff in the solicitor's office that are experts in dealing with federal government unions and collective bargaining.
Now, I trust them fully. You are a labor and employment attorney, and you were a leader at the department for years, correct?
That's
and you don't know about collective bargaining agreements?
I know about them, but I would trust the experts who have done this their entire career to help guide us.
Thank you.
Senator Hawley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sonderling, nice to see you again. I enjoyed our conversation the other day. I've been talking about a pro-worker framework for policy and legislation that I hope to advance in this Congress, doing common sense things like delivering transparency in the workforce, holding abusive employers accountable, making union elections fair and timely, getting fair and timely initial contracts when employees vote for union, and boosting penalties for unfair treatment. You and I have talked about this some. You kindly offered in my office to work with me and provide technical feedback on the legislation and other forms of support. Are you willing to reaffirm that today and to help us as we try to advance in this Congress legislation that will protect workers along the lines that President Trump has talked about and also strengthen our economy?
Senator, I enjoyed our conversation. I enjoy not only your passion for the workforce, but also President Trump's vision on bringing everyone together in his administration. And as we discussed, For you or any other senator, you have the full resources of the Department of Labor for any technical assistance on any part of the bills that this Congress decides that they would like to move forward or any of the senators want to sponsor. We will be there to assist you, providing technical guidance through both our political and career staff to make sure that you all can pass legislation.
Good, very good. Thank you for that. Let me ask you a little bit about artificial intelligence, which is something else that you and I discussed, and I enjoyed our conversation. You talked about your tenure at the EEOC and your role that you played helping to determine the appropriate uses for AI in hiring. What role do you think AI should play when it comes to federal hiring?
I think that we have to look at this, whether it's the federal government or the private sector, the same way. The tools that are being developed out of Silicon Valley are being used in the hiring process, not just here in the U.S., but across the world. And I think the U.S. needs to obviously lead in that innovation, and we need to keep that innovation here, but how do we do that? And that's what we discussed, making sure that all these tools are designed in accordance with our longstanding laws, no matter what the use is. We talked about employment, but there's obviously another, a lot of different kinds of uses of artificial intelligence, and we are not going to be able to succeed as a global leader in AI without making sure that the products are developed, designed, and deployed in accordance with the laws that Congress has passed. Not new laws yet, not new government bodies, with what we have in the executive branch. And there's a lot of old laws that we can apply to this. They're not outdated. That's our job to apply.
Let me just zoom out on this a little bit and ask you more broadly. Many American workers are very concerned about losing their jobs to AI. Concerns that I think are very well-founded. What's your message to American workers who feel at risk from this so-called AI revolution and think, gee, pretty soon I'm not going to have a job at all?
Well, this is a very, very important conversation, and another conversation on how we win, making sure that all workplace workers who are going to be either using these tools, subject to these tools, are not fearful that they're going to be replaced by them. And that's really working with the entire AI community, whether it's the venture capitalists, the vendors, to ensure that these products are developed, designed, and deployed with that in mind, that this is going to essentially make your job easier, better, and you can be more enjoyable and thrive more in the workplace and not having that fear of displacement. And if these tools are used to displace workers, that's a whole different conversation that we need to have before that occurs to make sure that all protections in the workforce are built into these systems, because if they're not, then that's a part we could use law enforcement if jobs are improperly being displaced by artificial intelligence, the same way we would do if it was by humans.
Yeah, I just want to, I'm glad to hear that answer, and I just want to register a concern here that I've registered in another context, which is we hear a lot about the AI revolution and how wonderful it's going to be for workers. And I hope that that's true. And I think it should be the business of this Congress to make sure it is true, because what I am not willing to see are large amounts of jobs, or really any number of good-paying jobs, ruined, destroyed, taken by AI. We have too few good-paying blue-collar jobs in this country. I don't want an AI revolution that takes away even more of those jobs. I remember when the CEO of Microsoft, not so long ago, was sitting where you're sitting and testifying before a different committee of which I was a member, and he said, oh, we should love AI. It's wonderful. Soon, we will automate and take away all kinds of non-creative jobs that we really don't need in this country anymore, like everyone who might work at a service restaurant, for example. We just won't need any of those people. I said to him, that's not a utopia. That sounds to me like a dystopia. That sounds to me like you're eliminating hundreds of thousands, millions of jobs that are often the way that workers get their foot in the door, they get into the labor force. So I'm glad to hear your answers. I'm glad for your work on AI. We've got to make sure that our workers are benefiting from this technology, not being ravaged and preyed upon by this technology.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kim.
Thank you, Chair. I actually just want to pick up exactly where that left off. Just try to get a little bit more clarity on your position regarding AI. I saw a quote that you had given previously where you said, quote, less enforcement we have, and you were talking about federal regulation, less enforcement we have on AI is a good thing because employees aren't having their rights violated and employers aren't violating these laws. So I guess I just wanted to ask you more specifically, what role do you think the federal government can and should play when it comes to AI regulation, as we're worried in a bipartisan way about job loss and replacement, not augmentation of work, but replacement.
And I'm not sure I said it exactly like that, but what I meant to say, if AI can actually be designed in accordance with not only our nation's laws and our nation's values, we can hopefully, with a lot of qualifiers, get to a place where AI discriminates less than humans in the employment application process in the throughout the employee life cycle. You know, as a former commissioner at the EEOC, we see that bias in employment decision-making occurs, and there's a lot of statistics related to that. What I was saying, if AI is designed, developed, and employed in a transparent manner where we can understand what the factors are that go into that, it can discriminate less. And if there's less discrimination, there's less enforcement. That was the context of that very specific. It was very much on the employment side in a very specific context. And, you know, what I was arguing there is, you know, if we have it right, we can actually have a contemporaneous record of how an employment decision was being made. If you think right now how an employment decision is being made, if there's bias, we don't know what was in that hiring manager's brain. We can't crack that. And when you ask somebody if they discriminated, very rarely does anyone actually ever admit that. So what I was saying is that if we get the AI transparent, we can actually see those employment decisions, see if it was fair or see if it was biased. And that's very hard to do right now without technology.
That's a helpful clarification. I guess I'd like to expand it and get your sense then, you know, kind of along the lines of what my colleague was just asking. Are there any particular industries and sectors where you think that AI and next-generation technologies can get to a place where they are replacing and displacing workers, not augmenting? I'm just wondering, are there certain areas, certain sectors, certain types of jobs you are worried about and you would want to keep an eye on as the deputy?
Yeah, that's a great question, and there's been a lot of very fancy studies done on this. And, you know, putting my former EEOC commissioner hat on, what I was concerned with from that job is who is going to, who would it disproportionately impact from a discrimination standpoint? How do we go back?
Sorry, I'm not asking about the employment side. I'm asking about actually, like, you know, are you worried about, for instance, the trucking industry? Are you worried about?
Yeah.
So tell me, you know, I'm trying to help people in New Jersey, across this country, understand what are the vulnerabilities when it comes to our workforce, when it comes to AI, and get your perspective as someone who may very well play a critical role in this.
Yeah, and this is where we have to, you know, use the other side of the Department of Labor to make sure that if there are people being displaced by AI jobs, which I was getting to, is inevitable, that we have the tools to be able to reskill, upskill, whatever the fancy buzzword
of those individuals. My question is, what jobs are you worried about? What industries are you worried about? And then we can hone in on figure out how to try to address that, how to be able to provide people in those industries certain types of training and whatnot.
Well, I mean, if you look at the jobs being displaced by generative AI, you know, a lot of those are knowledge worker jobs. A lot of those are jobs that have been historically done within an office. And now, you know, that's an area that we need to reskill and make sure that there are remaining parts of their job. And if not, where else in the workforce do they fit with those skills that they previously had?
I just want to switch here and switch gears. I just want to ask you, do you support the work that OSHA does regarding safe workplaces and environments?
Of course. It is one of the most important missions of the Department of Labor to ensure that all workers have a healthy and safe workplace.
Do you think OSHA has been sufficiently funded over the years?
I am committed to doing a full workplace analysis, not just on OSHA, but every other enforcement agency within the Department of Labor to make sure that each agency has the investigative and law enforcement and safety resources that they need.
There have been some efforts in the past to try to cut OSHA. When I was over in the House, we saw, you know, $95 million proposals by the House Republicans to cut OSHA. Does that concern you at all?
If confirmed, I will look at all the, not only the workplace makeup, but also the budgetary needs for the department and work with the White House and this Congress to make sure that the agencies are able to function with the proper budget.
But you recognize the importance of this, and if you're confirmed, you'll work with this committee to make sure that it's being protected to the level that we need to ensure safe work environments.
I will confirm and assure you that for all the agencies within the Department of Labor are all very important. And as Deputy Secretary, we will make sure that everyone has the resources they need.
Thank you. I yield back.
Senator Moody.
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Sonderling, number one, go Gators.
Go Gators.
So important. We must get that out of the way.
You missed a photo with two Florida senators. Former Senator George Lemieux is here.
Go Gators is ruled out of order.
Oh, yes. No, oh, I just lost my confirmation. Go Tigers.
not see a former Lemieux who I have the honor of now serving in his senatorial line. So
you missed the Florida picture.
We'll have to make up for that. I was the first time we met was in the office when I got to interview for this important nomination. I was so impressed with you, not just because of your incredible educational pedigree, but your grasp of what this department does, what it is meant to do, what it is not meant to do, and the way that you have volunteered so selflessly when you could be doing so much in the private world, probably to your pecuniary benefit, but using your talents and your gifts of God to benefit this nation and this country that you love. It was very inspiring to me, and I just want you to know that.
Thank you.
You know, the American labor plays a vital role in creating our wealth in this nation. It's with the department's founding that the federal government sought to balance the rights of the American laborer with the innovation and growth of American industry. And this was a noble goal that was set forth in our earliest days, and although we were not always perfect, it was through our efforts of a self-governing people and through our innovation that we came to create the freest and most dynamic economy in the world. Yet, under the previous administration, I was surprised and disappointed when I saw the department veer from this crucial mission and instead take many times a hostile stand against the independence of the American worker and the productivity of American business. And rather than facilitate the collaboration and cooperation between Americans in all sectors, the administration seemed to divide American from American. And in pursuit of political and ideological ends, Biden-appointed officials overzealously interpreted the law to the detriment of Americans and attacked states that deviated from their ideological line. We talked a lot about this during your interview. In Florida, we had federal funding threatened because our legislature, as representatives of the people of Florida, dared to pass a law that limited automatic dues withdrawals from paychecks and other common sense reforms. In response, I filed suit on behalf of Florida. And I believe the department can play a vital role in growing our economy and at the same time protecting the American worker while respecting the rights of the states to pass common sense laws. I think it is very important right now at this moment in our country's history that the American worker and the American business and the American economy comes first. And we can do that at the same time. And I believe you and your team will make that a reality. But the Department of Labor must return to its core mission, and that is to help make this country productive again. And I just want to get from you, Mr. Sondling, I know we talked about several things in our meeting, but when the Biden administration threatened to withhold federal funding after Florida enacted landmark legislation that enabled public workers to make their own decisions on whether to join a union and prohibited unions from withdrawing union dues directly from employees' paychecks without consent, we had to bring litigation over that because $800 million was on the line to our state. I would like to know how you will prevent that from happening in the future, and do you respect the rights of states to enact common sense right-to-work laws?
Thank you, Senator. And number one, as you know, this issue is in litigation, and the Department of Justice represents the Department of Labor. However, you know, I can assure you, as Deputy Secretary of Labor, all the laws that the U.S. Department of Labor enforces will be done so fairly. And without any political bias or prejudice, period. And I think, you know, to just speaking broadly about the Department of Labor under jurisdiction under the Federal Transit Act related to certifying the funds going to certain states, you know, and very technical issue with that 13C requirement with six various elements, what I can assure you is that all elements like that that the Department of Labor has to make a judgment call on will be done so in accordance with the law and nothing else. And no political bias will be injected into that. You have my absolute assurance, whether it's on that issue or any issue across the board. To your second question, of course, I respect states being able to pass bills. You know, the bill you referenced, Florida Senate Bill 256, Florida is completely within its jurisdiction to do that, and other states are similar as well. And I will continue to respect that as Deputy Secretary of Labor.
And I want to just tell the committee as I wrap this up, I had a whole other line of questioning regarding the lost children and the Department of Labor's involvement in that. But your preparation and ability to handle not only my interviews, but some very tough questions. You were on the spot. You knew everything and had a great response to every question. I know you will serve incredibly well in this role. I have great confidence in you.
No Florida bias there.
None at all.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sonderling, the president has indicated that he wants to bring back presidential impoundment authority. The Congressional Impoundment Act of 1974 puts limits on the president's authority to impound funds. I serve on the subcommittee of appropriations that funds the Department of Labor. And you... I would like to hear whether you will ensure that funding decisions that are made and passed by this Congress are implemented as intended.
First of all, you know, as Deputy Secretary, it will be my first time really diving into the federal budget process, and I look forward very much to working with you and ensuring that at all times, any decisions related to funding or the department's use and spending of that funding is absolutely coordinated with our career solicitor's office, who understands those laws.
When Congress passes appropriation bills funding the Department of Labor and its various subdivisions, will you implement as Congress intends?
I will always follow the law.
Okay. In the past month, you have been the senior advisor to acting Secretary of Labor. In that time, the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, has received access to large data sets within the Department of Labor, which include an incredible amount of very sensitive data, including medical and financial records of Americans. Mr. Sonderling, in your role as senior advisor, how are you interacting with and working with DOGE?
Well, I can assure you that everything related to DOGE at the Department of Labor is being handled right now by the Department of Justice. There was a lawsuit filed by unions against the Department of Labor related to DOGE's access to the department. The Department of Justice.
What is the question that is before the court with regard to DOGE's access?
Whether or not they're allowed to have access to any systems of the Department of Labor.
Okay, so you can answer then a question of have they been given access previously?
I would have to refer you to the court documents that lays out all of the access.
Is that the question before the court?
Yes, among other things related to DOGE, but any access to any system.
So the question is, have they even had access to the data?
That was all being dealt with through the Department of Justice.
You can't even ask the question of whether you've interacted with anybody from DOGE in your capacity as the senior advisor to the acting Secretary of Labor.
Everything related to DOGE is tied up in the Department of Justice's defense of the lawsuit related to their access or their system.
Who could I ask this question to?
The Department of Justice represents the Department of Labor in this matter.
So the Department of Justice would tell me who at Labor has had access. We need to be able to ask questions about what has happened to the sensitive data of Americans, including medical records and financial records. And you're saying you can't answer that question, even though you've been there as this access has taken place?
Everything related to the DOGE's access or requested access to the Department of Labor is in litigation right now here in D.C., and the Department of Justice represents the Department of Labor on all of those matters.
One of the sets of records that they may have access to is with regard to OSHA. OSHA collects a lot of information with regard to their enforcement of rules about workplace safety. Does DOGE have access to OSHA records at this point in time?
Everything related to DOGE's access to the Department of Labor is being dealt with in court in D.C. and the Department of Justice representative.
The access frozen during the court's contemplation of these issues?
According to my knowledge of the lawsuit, which is all based on public information, there has been zero access given.
Can you make any comment about last week's report that OSHA closed a case regarding a worker's death at a Tesla plant in Austin, Texas?
I am not aware of that.
You're not aware of that?
No. I would defer you to the leadership in OSHA.
One of the issues that I have been involved with is, frankly, how dangerous it is to be a healthcare worker and a social worker at this point in time in terms of workplace violence. Do you support OSHA's role in creating rules to address workplace violence faced by our healthcare personnel and social workers?
If confirmed, I will assure you that I will look into this issue and work specifically with your office on this issue because it is important to you and everyone else.
Mr. Chair, I've run out of time.
Now, I'll go to Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Sonneling. Good to see you.
Nice to see you.
Appreciate your time and access. Back on January 25th, President Trump fired the 17 inspectors general across 18 agencies, including the IG at the Department of Labor. We didn't get any notice or any rationale. The administration set goals to reduce fraud and waste. But the firing inspectors from their posts, it's stalling many of the audits on federal resources. It is definitely reducing transparency to the public. We get hundreds of calls about what's going on. Most of the question today has been around this stuff. But you were part of the transition. Did you hear any rationale for getting rid of those inspector generals en masse, all of them at once?
That was a decision that only President Trump can make as the leader of the executive branch, and it is his authority, within his full authority, to make all personnel decisions related to the executive branch.
But you don't really hear why, what the rationale was. I don't argue he's got the authority. I'm just curious whether he gave a rationale to, you know, you folks doing the work.
I'm not aware.
And you have an acting inspector general now, I understand.
Yes.
And is that inspector general overseeing some of this effort to reduce fraud and waste?
We do have an acting inspector general with the full powers of an inspector general. And that they are separate from the Department of Labor. We don't have direct oversight of them. If I'm deputy secretary, they're independent, so I believe they are functioning in full capacity.
And what kind of a vetting process did this inspector general go through?
The acting general count?
Yes, the person in place now.
I'm not sure. He was here before I started, and I think he's a career employee now in the acting position.
So you have confidence in the work he's doing?
I have 100% confidence in the Department of Labor.
Great.
And all the visions in the staff there.
And you have a broad experience in government, some of the broadest, actually, of people we've talked to in any of these confirmation hearings. You obviously understand the importance of whistleblowers, of making sure that we can get, you know, relevant information at the relevant time and make sure that the public feels like there's no cover-up, that there's no secret deals going on. And we can find ways to understand what the workers are going through and find ways to improve it, to productivity, get rid of fraud and waste. What assurances are we able to give those workers that they can blow the whistle, as it were, report issues that they think are of real importance, and yet be protected from repercussions?
Well, Senator, this is a very important issue for the Department of Labor. As you know, OSHA enforces over 25 whistleblower laws that Congress has determined that should be at the Department of Labor, even for areas outside of our jurisdiction. So it is a very important part of the Department of Labor to deal with whistleblower cases across many federal statutes. To your specific question, there are whistleblower laws. As a former EEOC commissioner, there's also retaliation protection related to, you know, some of those laws as well. And I can assure you that all laws that the Department of Labor enforces, we will continue to do that.
Great. I appreciate that. Last, and I, you know, I was a, you'll remember when we talked to mayor for a while, governor.
A lot of things.
8 years as mayor, 8 years as governor. And we did work to make government smaller. And one of the things we you and I discussed this a little bit, but when you're having layoffs, and we've seen layoffs now in six of the departments in labor, the morale is so important. And what steps do you anticipate taking when confirmed, if confirmed? How do you go about addressing the issues about morale? Because we are hearing from a number of employees, not people that have been laid off, but employees that they feel disheartened, disenchanted, that their morale is very low.
Yeah, I think, you know, two things. One, if confirmed, I will make sure that all applicable laws and regulations are applied in any kind of workforce development changes. Number two, I think it's very important, and I think the Department of Labor employees and all employees throughout the federal government truly believe in their mission. And I think a lot of it is going to be refocusing on the purpose of these agencies at the DOL to protect the American workforce.
Right. Well, there are no laws about morale, so I guess I'll end it there. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, very much. Mr. Sonderling, I believe that workers should be able to clock into work knowing that they'll return home safe. When my father was a young man, working in a factory, his finger got chopped off. And the boss said to him, you should probably go to a doctor, John, and see it work on Monday. So my father used to use another finger on the same hand to describe his attitude towards the boss, and that was before OSHA was put on the books as a law. And he would make fun of that situation with us, but we know that he missed his finger. Now, at the time, Republicans said, well, if you put something like OSHA on the books, it's Marxist. You can't have that kind of Marxism going into the private sector. It's just a private bargain between an individual and the worker and the company. But of course, my father didn't view it that way. He supported OSHA being put on the books. So 200 workers lose a finger or an arm or a leg at work every single month in America today. 200 Americans. An arm, a leg, or a finger at work every single month. And there are also 5,000 workplace fatalities every single year in the United States of America, which translates into about 15 workers dying every single day across our country. So even with OSHA on the books, and it was much worse, okay, no question, it was much worse in the 40s, in the 50s. Okay. But it still is a lot of people every single day. Yet according to the Department of Labor's own data, there's only one health and safety inspector per 4,300 workplaces and 70,000 workers in the country, even today. That's all there is, one per 4,300 workplaces. When the Department of Labor can't enforce worker safety laws, it's a handout, obviously, to greedy companies that abuse their workers for profit. In 2023, for example, Amazon brought in $30 billion in profit. And that same year, 1 in 15 Amazon warehouse workers were injured on the job, breaking their own backs, toiling under oppressive surveillance and punitive speed quotas to make a buck for their boss. Yet since President Trump was inaugurated, he and Elon Musk have fired Department of Labor employees. They've deleted worker safety information. They've deleted the worker safety information from their websites. And yesterday, they demanded the department create a plan for mass staff layoffs. So, Mr. Sondling, do you commit today to protecting workers from employers like Amazon so that every worker can go to work knowing that they will come home safe at the end of the day to their families?
Senator Markey, thank you for that story about your father. It's one I may use moving forward, if that's okay. As far as you have my full commitment, and I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for protecting the American worker for worker safety. So you have my full commitment, if confirmed, as Deputy Secretary of Labor. I will go through each law enforcement agency and make sure that there is adequate resources, including determining that the investigators are in the places they need to be with the highest violations.
So you will oppose any action that would make workers less safe? You would oppose any action?
That the law is to make make the worker safe. Okay. I will uphold the law.
You would oppose any action.
I will.
Would reduce safety.
And what I read from...
Is that yes? You will oppose anything that will reduce safety?
I have confidence that, you know, even in the OPM directive and the executive order, it says that health and safety inspectors are exempt.
Would you oppose taking a chainsaw to the resources at the agencies that would enable the Department of Labor to enforce those worker safety laws? Would you oppose that?
I would give you my assurances that I will work with all the law enforcement agencies to have the resources they need.
Yeah, I'm not hearing a yes. Would you oppose anything that would actually result in an increase in the number of fingers, arms, other body parts that are cut off? Would you oppose anything that would manifestly result in an increase in the danger to workers in the workplace over in the year 2025 or 2026?
Yeah, if confirmed, do you have my assurances from both the Secretary and I that we will do everything to protect worker safety?
I appreciate what you're saying. Will you'll oppose anything that will increase the number of people losing their fingers, their arms?
Faithfully enforce the law with all the department's resources.
I'm not hearing a yes. Again, my father would want a yes. Okay, I'm listening to you, Pop. I can't get the answer from him. And I know that he sounds a lot like the boss that you were not happy with. I just need guarantees here, and I'm not hearing the guarantees to make sure that corporations can't increase profits at the expense of the public health workers. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
This concludes our hearing. Thank you for being here, Mr. Sondland.
Thank you, Senator.
For any senators who wish to add additional questions for the record will be due by tomorrow at 5 p.m. And again, we gavel out. Good job, Andrew.